From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Illinois has lost six congressional seats since 1960, and there are experts who predict that we will lose one or even two after the 2020 census. We need to work as hard as we can to get an accurate count so Illinois will get the representation that we deserve.
For the upcoming 2020 count, it is critical to capture underrepresented communities that are often overlooked. They're not given what is needed in policy and economic investments.
We have hard to count communities, specifically, especially with the Latino community, which 10 years ago, unfortunately, had an undercount. And about specifically to our babies, our children, our toddlers were undercounted by almost 500,000. And that is that's a congressional district right there alone. And so we need to make sure that we are having everyone, all residents of the state of Illinois and in this country counted, no matter of their immigration status or not. If you live in this state, you should be counted. You are one of us, you are a neighbor, you are family, and we care for you.
That's the Senator Omar Aquino. Also heard Representative Camille Lilly in there and Governor J.B. Pritzker. The governor signing an executive order this week. It has to do with the upcoming census count. We'll talk about that and what is at stake for Illinois. That and more coming up here on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. Joining me in studio, Charlie Wheeler. He's director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. And in our Statehouse studio, we have the IPR Statehouse editor, Brian Mackey. And joining us this week from Capital News Illinois, Jerry Nowicki. And Jerry, good to have you on with us.
Thanks for having me.
Jerry, I'll start with you. The governor signed an executive order, had to do with the census. What is this all about?
So they want to ensure an accurate count, and they have put in $29 million from the budget this year. And what's at stake is up to two congressional seats, the governor said, and as his Lieutenant Governor Stratton said, we could lose about $120 million a year for every 1% that is undercounted. So they really want to make sure everybody's getting counted in that census.
And what are some of the concerns with undercounting the census? I mean, are they fearful that that's going to happen? I know there's always some adjustments made to the census every time it's done, but is there something that's more concerning to them this year?
I don't know if it's more concerning this year, but with the out-migration, we've been seeing for a while, there's a likelihood that we're going to lose at least one seat. But if they lost two congressional seats, that's a pretty big deal. And the citizenship question, which could appear on the census, Senator Aquino said that's just an intimidation tactic from the president to kind of edge out Latino communities, immigrant communities that should be counted in the census anyway, because the census counts residents, not citizens.
Charlie, Jerry mentioned some of the things that are at stake for the state of Illinois, and people may not realize that, but so much is dependent upon the census and the census being as accurate as possible when it comes to federal money, when it comes to congressional representation. Like you said, this is a big deal for the state.
Oh, yeah, it's a very big deal. And as a matter of fact, Jerry mentioned the challenge to the citizenship question. There is some evidence that at least some of President Trump's strategists, Republican strategists, thought that if we included a citizenship question on the census, which hasn't been there for more than 50 years, that this would be a deterrent for non-documented individuals, the so-called illegal aliens, to not step up to be counted, and that this therefore would depress the number of people, particularly in Hispanic communities, which tend to vote Democratic, and that this would be a plus for Republicans. And that question ultimately will be decided whether or not the Census Bureau can ask for a citizen or put in a citizenship question. Are you a citizen of the U.S.? That will ultimately be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, probably before summer is out. And it's not just the representation in Congress, but if you think about it, the communities that tend to be hard to count, it's not suburban neighborhoods where everybody has a nice house and everybody has the internet and you can see pretty easily who's there. It tends to be inner cities, lower income people, people of color, people who are of a Hispanic background, and they tend to live in larger cities, they tend to be Democratic. And so the impact in Illinois would have an internal effect also if there's an undercount, because the state's 59 Senate and 118 House districts are apportioned according to population. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the last redistricting we had, based on the 2010 census numbers, the legislative district that had the most people only had one individual more than the district that had the fewest. That's how precise it is. And if there's an undercount, say, in communities of color in Chicago, that would dilute Chicago's legislative strength. It also would have an impact because there's a lot of money that the state doles out that's based on population. For example, for 50 years, ever since we've had an income tax, there's been a slice of the income tax that gets returned to cities and counties, and that's based on population. So if there's an undercount, for example, in Chicago, whereas maybe a town like Springfield or a town like Bloomington has a good count, that means some dollars that rightfully should be going to Chicago instead will be going to some downstate communities. So there's a lot more at stake than just congressional representation, although that is obviously probably the most significant factor in terms of the state.
And I can add just a personal experience here. I was a census taker back in 2000. Toward the end of my college education. I ended up landing a civil service job as a field operations supervisor for the 2000 census. One of the areas that our responsibility was Joliet. And there are some very economically depressed areas of Joliet where residents are pretty suspicious of coming to the door to talk to government officials, even friendly census takers. And so you already have challenges in getting people to respond to the census. But with the atmosphere that the president is stirring up with the citizenship question, as well as, you know, his vow to deport people, it certainly seems like it could make it that much more challenging to get people to respond.
One of the interesting things at the press conference yesterday was that Governor Pritzker had said, you know, we got to get people that are from these communities and that look like the people in these communities and have connections with people in these communities to go out and knock on those doors, mm-hmm. and to just make connections and meet one-on-one and build that type of trust with the people in those communities.
Yeah, and that certainly would have been helpful. I don't know how the federal government might have changed its hiring procedures. You know, there were tests. The tests were only at certain times. You couldn't really necessarily have outside groups, at least as I recall. Again, this is almost 20 years ago now, coming with you on these door knockings. But, you know, it definitely helps to have people from the communities. The Census Bureau tried to do that, but there were just some areas where you got more people applying for jobs and other areas where people weren't. I mean, there is just a question of, do people even know these jobs are available in their areas? And so if this $29 million is put to that sort of outreach in advance, educating people, letting them know, hey, you can make pretty decent wages. It's only for a few months, but it's pretty good money for this type of work. And you can get some familiar faces from those neighborhoods, then that should improve participation.
Yeah, and there will be lots of grants to community organizations that are already well involved in this, and the governor said he wants to get that grant money out the door as soon as possible. So we'll see how that works out.
We'll continue to watch that issue over the next several months as Illinois gets ready for the census count. Let's move on to something that has already been signed into law, the Illinois state budget for the next fiscal year, which takes effect July 1st. Higher education got more money in this budget, something that the advocates for higher ed have been looking for a long time. And Brian, did they get as much as they wanted?
Well, it's never really as much as they wanted, is it? It is an increase, but higher ed has been one of the areas of the state budget that has, at least in terms of operating money, has been really, really diminished over the past couple of decades, not only in real terms, but particularly when adjusted for inflation. The higher ed, and I don't have the percentage off the top of my head, but it's significantly lower than what the state contributed. Now, there are critics who will say, well, a lot of that money has been crowded out because Illinois is contributing so much more to the state university retirement system, to university pensions, which, full disclosure, all of us on this panel except Jerry are members of the state university retirement system. But this is something where higher ed has been really losing a lot of state support because of that. Tuition has been going up, and partially because of that, Illinois has seen a lot more students than used to choosing to go out of state for college and university.
Jerry, you've been covering this issue as well and writing about it. What stood out to you regarding higher education and the money in the state budget?
Well, I spoke to the Board of Higher Education, and they're actually really excited as well about the capital funding. I think there's $2 billion in new funding, and they're somewhere around $1 billion in funding that hadn't been appropriated from previous capital plans. So they're saying the new facilities, you know, and they see it'll just entice the students to stay in Illinois. Say, look at the state's now making this investment in education, and, you know, we might go to this school to see the new nursing facilities come to fruition and to be able to work in those and just other facilities like that. So there's a lot to be excited about, is what they told me at IBHE.
And Charlie, when it comes to higher education and the building or capital money, as we talk about, you know, you can look at that two ways. You need good facilities. You need facilities that are up to date technically. At the same time, the more you do build, especially new structures, that's more upkeep that's going to be costly to the facilities going forward, to the universities going forward. So you can look at that a couple of different ways.
Yeah, and I suppose the balancing act is between building a new building and having to spend a lot of money on upkeep, maintenance, preventive work on an old building that's kind of crumbling. I know I, as part of my position as director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program, I visit campuses across the state every spring to recruit people. And you go to some of the places and some of the buildings are really in poor condition. And they're old, they need upkeep, which is expensive too. And so I think the capital program has something in there for, I believe, every one of the public universities in the state. And there's a pot of money for private universities' capital, too. It's the kind of thing that we only do these capital plans, unfortunately, maybe once a decade, and so stuff piles up. We're going to have a new library resource center here at UIS. I know down in Carbondale they're going to replace the communications building, which, no offense to the folks at Southern, but it is in pretty decrepit shape. And so it's a question of, well, I guess it's like if you have an automobile. At one point, do you get rid of your clunker because in the long run it's cheaper to buy a new one than to continue to keep making repairs on the old one?
Well, Jerry, you talked about the fact of they're hoping to bring or bring more students back into these campuses, but we have seen many schools in the state of Illinois that have seen declining enrollment. And so when you talk about this type of investment, it may be important certainly for the campuses, but at the same time, you know, they don't have the enrollment levels to pay the way that they used to. So, you know, it's a bit of a gamble, I guess, to hope that some of these students come back, correct?
Yeah, it is. But they also mentioned there was $50 million in additional funding for MAP grants, which the monetary award program, which allows a lot of students to, you know, be able to get their education because it makes it financially feasible to them. And then there's an AIM High grant program, which also invests more money in it in some of the higher performing students. So, you know, combine those together, it might bring enrollment up. But yeah, I think it certainly is a gamble because you just don't know how that'll go in the future.
And with so many of these higher ed institutions downstate, oftentimes represented by Republicans, it's one of those areas of bipartisanship as well, right?
It is. Eastern Illinois was a big one. They were very vocal in the whole Capitol bill process. They had frequently mentioned a science building where they'd have to cover their equipment with garbage bags to prevent it from being ruined by the leaky roofs. And I think they're getting a new funding for a new building in the Capitol plan. So that's another one of those where Charlie was talking about, where that's a cheaper thing to just completely overhaul rather than try to make those various repairs.
And I think another factor that enters into it is kind of the psychology, if you will. Because, again, on my trips around the state, I had faculty at other schools saying one of the difficulties they had in recruiting students was, particularly during the time of the budget impasse, parents would say to the professor, "Well, my daughter really likes your offerings, but can you guarantee me that the program will still be around for her full 4 years?" And it was difficult to make that commitment at a time when basically the administration was not investing. It was kind of disinvesting, if you will, in higher education. And I think the atmosphere, the environment has changed dramatically with our new budget and with the fact that we have a new governor who seems more inclined to value higher education rather than to kind of cast it by the wayside.
Well, another higher education story that came up here over the last week or so was the announcement at Western Illinois University that the president there for the last several years, Jack Thomas, that he will be stepping down. He's been facing quite a bit of criticism over the last few years as well, and he's going to be stepping down really quickly here at the end of this month on June 30th, and they've appointed a temporary replacement for him. They're probably going to appoint an interim president and do a national search for somebody to take over that vacancy. Brian, the big story, I think, that came out of that, though, was how the agreement was made for him to leave. He's getting quite a big severance package.
Yeah, he sure is. And this is relying somewhat on a story in the Chronicle of Higher Education, which noted that this is, as they put it, outside of education's national norms in terms of this severance package. Now, we should say that Jack Thomas had a pretty bad hand dealt to him, right? He's leading one of these university in an area of the state that, you know, a couple decades ago, even people were saying was known as Forgottonia, right? Because there was no good interstate access to that part of Western Illinois. So you have those issues. Then the state budget impasse comes. And higher ed is one of the areas that is particularly shorted, on top of the shorting of regular operational funding for higher education that we were talking about. And Western was one of the places really hard hit. They've had layoffs of staff. They've had layoffs of faculty. They've announced of interest perhaps to our listeners that the public radio station is no longer going to be supported or getting any appropriations from the university to continue its operation. And that paid for several of the staff members there, as well as facilities and electricity and things like that. But this severance package is raising a lot of eyebrows. So he leaves, and typical, apparently, according to the Chronicle of Higher Ed, it's you get a one-year deal where you might stay in your salary. It gives you time to kind of do a national search. He's getting 2 years at his base salary of $270,000. Plus, he's also going to be, the university will be contributing to his retirement, paying for life insurance and health insurance. It brings his entire compensation package up to about $300,000 a year. He also has the option to come back as a professor at the university at the end of that time, at the end of this sort of two-year do-nothing contract. He can come back as a professor, and a really well-paid one at that, paid much higher than any other professor on campus, according to the Chronicle. So this is, it's raising a lot of eyebrows. And, you know, we've heard before, there's some legislators and even Governor Rauner who have really raised questions about compensation at universities. I think it's, you know, it's one thing where you have maybe in a field like computer science, where people really can become, you know, 100,000 heirs, if not millionaires, working at Facebook and Google and places like that. You need to get a top computer scientist. That can be harder. Same thing with, you know, physicians, perhaps, at, you know, in very competitive specialties like neurosurgery at a medical school. But particularly the cost of administration has been something that has stuck in the craw of a lot of state legislators over the years, and one imagines that this could continue to do so.
Also announced here, somebody else leaving, and that is the Representative Mike McAuliffe. He is the son of Roger McAuliffe. You might remember him from a few years back. He died while in office, and Michael McAuliffe took over for him, the representative. What makes that seat so interesting is they were the only Republicans who were representing the city of Chicago in the Illinois legislature, and this would be the end of a 46-year run of the McAuliffe family representing that district. They're still working on who might take it over, but there is some discussion that it could be somebody from outside of Chicago. That district does run there as well. Charlie, that's kind of a unique, we'll make for a unique little bit of trivia.
Yeah, it will, because if, for example, the mayor of Rosemont, Brad Stevens, I believe is his name, is appointed, as there's some speculation that he might be, he has, I don't know if he's got the majority of the votes to replace Michael McAuliffe. The way it's done, when a lawmaker leaves, the party leaders in his district, and in the case of this Northwest Side district, it'll be ward committeemen from Chicago, township committeemen from neighboring townships, get together and they vote based on the weighted vote based on primary results. How did their party fare in the last primary in their area? And so if Stevens from Rosemont becomes the representative, it will be the first time since at least 1872 that there has not been a Republican from the city of Chicago. And I can say that with conviction. You know, despite the fact that I talk about what an old guy I am, I was not here in 1872. But the 1870 Constitution provided for cumulative voting, in which voters elected three members from each House district. And as it worked out over the years, it meant that every district had at least one Republican and one Democrat, with a few exceptions. And so there had been a Republican there since at least 1872, and maybe before. And as I say, if the replacement for Michael McAuliffe is Stevens or someone else from the suburbs, then for the first time in that long period, there will not be a single Republican lawmaker from the city of Chicago.
And I should mention that Michael McAuliffe says he wants to spend more time with his family. That's why he is stepping down. Brian, just a couple of minutes left here. Senate Republican leader Bill Brady appeared before the City Club in Chicago this past week, answered some questions there. Can you give us a quick recap of what was discussed?
Yeah, he was talking about sort of touting the bipartisan accomplishments that the Republicans managed to get through the Democratic supermajorities in the legislature. You know, when a party finds itself in the superminority, as the Republicans are here, and as, you know, Democrats are in plenty of other states, you have a couple of choices, really. One of them is to try and throw spanners in the works, use parliamentary tactics to delay and prevent the majority from working its will as much as you can, and you know, yell loudly to try and get things stopped. And we certainly saw that a little bit. Republicans did take that approach, particularly in the House, on issues like abortion and on the graduated income tax constitutional amendment. On the other hand, if you're in a superminority party, you can try and, on the margins, make legislation you don't like a little bit less objectionable to you, or try and, you know, negotiate some compromise where you can find common ground. And Brady was saying, you know, we had plenty of people urging us to take the sort of thundering no approach, but, you know, we decided to try and find common ground where we could on things like the capital plan. You know, it isn't always that difficult to get politicians to agree to have ribbon cuttings and spend billions of dollars across the state on bridges and roads and buildings and things like that. But there are, you know, especially in the Republican Party, an increasing number of people who just sort of think that, you know, the smaller the government, the better. The government shouldn't be spending money on just about anything. You just can't trust Illinois government to deal with your money. Brady is not one of those people, and was sort of touting his accomplishments as he sees them in terms of getting things done and also getting some business friendly legislation. We've talked about this in the past weeks, but for example, tax credits for data centers and some other changes to tax laws that Republicans have wanted to see for and business community has wanted to see for a number of years.
And Brian, this was a 180 degree difference from what we saw under Bruce Rauner, when Republicans felt as though maybe they had an ally there, but also I think they were getting some direction from the governor's office to take a different approach. And as you mentioned, it's either you want a seat at the table, you need to work with people, or be prepared to be shut out.
Yeah, and that certainly did seem to be what, was threatening to happen. We were all, I can remember on May 31st, the supposedly last day of session, there was a lot of people going back and forth throughout the building. That's the day Governor Pritzker actually went and spoke to the private Republican Senate caucus meeting, that the caucus that Brady leads, which is the smallest legislative caucus of the four caucuses, Democrats and Republicans in the House and Senate. But ultimately they were able to get together on things like the budget, capital spending, infrastructure spending, things like that.
Okay. Time now to go to our notes from the field. Charlie, we'll start with you.
Well, there was news from the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library. A Bible that belonged to Abraham Lincoln is now going to be put on display. I guess it is now on display, and it will be there through the rest of the year in the Treasurer's Room. And it's a Bible that was presented to Abraham Lincoln at a fundraiser for medical care for Civil War Union veterans in Philadelphia. He was presented this Bible. His widow then gave it to the family of a Baptist minister who had been a neighbor and friend of the Lincolns. The Bible had stayed within that family from the time it was presented back in 1872 up until just recently, when the family decided to donate it to the Lincoln Presidential Library. And unlike some of the other artifacts that have very questionable provenance, particularly a top hat that supposedly once was Lincoln's, this Bible is genuine, and it's a real treasure, according to the people at the library.
Yeah. Jerry?
Farmers around the state are taking major risks in planting industrial hemp. We did a story last week that they're paying about 50 cents to a dollar per seed, and there's minimal crop insurance that they can get for what they got. So they're putting themselves out there with this new industry.
And Brian.
There was an Illinois Supreme Court decision in which it let the Walgreens company basically off the hook for improperly collecting taxes on sparkling water. Think of this as a consumer. You get to the register. How often are you thinking about, you say, okay, here's my dollar bottle. The person behind the counter says, okay, that's $1.13 or whatever it is. You pretty much trust them to get the taxes right. And if the company makes a mistake, what the Illinois Supreme Court has said, if you agree to pay the taxes when they're presented to you, there are no takebacks. In this case, Walgreens was improperly charging a 5-cent bottled water tax in Chicago on products that were not legally, technically bottled water. They were sparkling water. They were flavored juices, things like that. Somebody tried to sue with a class action, and the Supreme Court basically says, no, as long as you voluntarily pay the tax, your one time to really object to this is when you are standing at the register.
Okay, that will do it for this week. Members of our broadcast included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Jerry Nowicki with Capital News Illinois. Get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org. Production assistance for the program provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.